And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number 43. A welcome back to us after a brief hiatus.
Some of us went on vacation. Some of us stayed in Seattle. And
you know, I was I was in Croatia, to be honest.
That's a vacation. And Paris. That's a definite vacation.
It was an amazing vacation. And here's the thing about this is that I happened to see the island of Lokrum, which I am not a Game of Thrones person, but apparently a lot of Croatia and the island of Lokrum was used in the shooting of Game of Thrones.
And still is. Well, actually,
they pulled the productions there. They're now moving to New Zealand because they don't have enough snow in Croatia, right? So here's the other interesting thing about this, learn though, that the island of Lokrum, which is happens to be where the, apparently it's the Iron Throne.
That means
nothing to me, but that's apparently a big deal.
You can borrow the show.
The island throne, or the Iron Throne on the island of Lokrum, no one will stay there after dark in real life because there was a monastery there that got kicked off of the island like several hundred years ago and they cursed the island. And now there have been a horrible series of tragedies that have happened to anybody who's lived on that island.
So winter for that little island already come.
Yeah. And here's where it all comes together. The Archduke, Franz Ferdinand, lived on the island. Shortly thereafter was assassinated, which is what actually started, you know, World War One.
So,
I mean, these are tragedies and there is beholden to the monks. So I digress.
Should probably have a show now, shouldn't we?
Yeah. So here
Speaking of a show.
Yeah. All sorts of horror in store for us. Sarah Michelle Fetters, Adam Gierke. And you know who's back with us, Sarah?
I know. I'm so excited about this.
John Portnova.
Yes.
John, you're back with us. Creep on up to your microphone here. Say hello to the folks here at home.
Hello, everyone at home. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. So, John, you've come back to us. You put together an amazing film that was a part of
2015.
Did that play SIFF or was that STIFF?
It was SIFF.
SIFF. Yeah. Okay. It was fill me in here. It was the Valley of the Sasquatch
was the original title when it played at SIFF, and we're coming up on a home video release in a few months under the new title Hunting Ground.
Yeah. So we want to pick your brain on that, and we also want to pick your brain on all things Halloween-y and what have you.
Sounds good.
So feel free to chime in here. In the meantime, Sarah, a couple big films came out last week.
Well, a couple of big films came out for the entire month you were gone, but
let her rip,
Just go last week.
Yeah.
Last week we had Tim Burton returning with a new movie, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, which is based on the famous book series by Ransom Riggs. Kids everywhere just eat up these novels. They're a time-bending fantasy series. The first one essentially involves a kid named Jake Portman who goes to Wales to search out the children's home that his grandfather stayed at during World War II.
Okay.
And when he gets there, it's completely bombed out. It's gone. The Germans had destroyed it. But through a weird fracture in time, he is able to go back to the day of the bombing and meet Mrs. Peregrine herself, played by Eva Green, and all of her strange... get it? Peculiar children who have major mystical, fantastical powers.
The powers of levitation.
Exactly. He gets to befriend them all, and in the process discovers that his grandfather was in charge of protecting them, and now he has that power as well to protect these children from the forces of evil.
Wow. Okay. Where do you sit on this one real quick?
I liked it. I think the first half when Burton is setting up this world is classic Tim Burton. It's comical, it's gothic, it's strange. It fits really right in that Addams Family meets Vincent Price meets old Roger Corman mold of things.
Sure.
It's really intriguing. I was obsessed with it. I wanted to know more about little Jake, played by Asa Butterfield, and all these characters. I was just, I loved it. The last half hour, 45 minutes of the movie, you kind of feel like 20th Century Fox goes, okay, Tim, we gave you your time to kind of play, have fun, do what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
We now need you to sell some tickets. So we got to get to the action. We got to get to the craziness. We got to get to the part where they look like X-Men.
Sure.
Let's have all that whiz bang. And the movie kind of gets a little boring.
Okay.
I think it's a strong rental. I'd maybe even go mild theater, but I think strong rental is fine.
Okay, and does Danny Elfman do the score on this one?
He does not do the score this time out, and I will say it's missing. This is, if any movie recently for a Tim Burton film required a Danny Elfman score, it's this one.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children getting a rental. By the way, when I was in Paris, I happened to see that they had posters for that in the metro. So it was playing well. And if you were on Snapchat in Paris, you could turn one of the filters on and it would put you as a, it was like Miss Peregrine's Chez for Peculiar Enfants.
Apparently Tim Burton designed all those himself.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, he was really involved with the marketing this time around.
And it was marketing worldwide on that.
Yeah.
So. Okay, Deepwater Horizon also peeking on us.
Sure, I mean, and this one you should all know what it's about. It's about the April 2010 disaster at the Deepwater Horizon drilling plant in Louisiana, the offshore drilling station.
This is that one that just gushed oil forever and ever
that blew up, killed a bunch of people that were on board. And much like Clint Eastwood's Sully, this one is directed by Peter Berg, and it is only interested in the event itself.
Huh.
It only is concerned with what is going on during that event. It starts just before things go to pot, and it ends with everybody basically getting off the rig.
Okay.
I mean, that is the movie. It is just about the event. It's pretty much as apolitical as you can get in that regard. It does take the BP... bigwigs on the rig to task a little bit. By and large, they don't get, you know, they're not really brushed over the coals or anything here. It is about how people survived on the rig as it was blowing up. It's got Mark Wahlberg and Kurt Russell in two key roles. It's extremely well staged.
Yeah.
It's really well directed on Berg's part. It's fascinating. It's entertaining. It's thrilling. There's absolutely no meat on the bones whatsoever. So unlike Sully, which tries to dig a little bit deeper into who the captain was and what was going through his head.
And we've got the family that's trying to reconnect to play golf and yada.
Sure, that stuff I could have cared less about. But I mean, there's enough interior dynamics that I'm a little bit warmer to that film than I am to this one. It's still really entertaining and it does get the job done and it's efficient as all get out.
Okay. So a theater renter, a skip on
I
that one?
I think it's a theater. It's a solid theater. It's not like Rush right away, but I mean, if you can go to a matinee or when it gets to, you know, your $6, $7 theater, go see it. I mean, especially because the sound design, anything, is just fantastic. And apparently, I mean, they spent like $140, $150 million on this.
Sure.
The actual destruction of the Deepwater Horizon itself is pretty amazing.
The sound of imploding steel and things burning up and bubbling.
Oh yeah, wow. It's pretty shocking.
Okay,
it's a disaster movie, but it's
on a smaller scale.
Yeah, on a smaller scale, and it's fine.
Okay, you know the weird thing about that is do they touch on the fact that it was just months later that they couldn't find any of the oil in the Gulf? The company tried when
they don't touch on anything of the afterwards. I mean, it's just the event.
All right, because that was the weird thing about that whole thing is that all this oil gushed everywhere, and it gushed for days. I mean, John, do you remember this when this was happening, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And then they came in, they used some cleaning agent, and it broke the oil down to the point then, like, a month later, there was almost no trace of this stuff. Really weird, kind of creepy.
Isn't that the stuff that Kevin Costner sold them?
Right, for Waterworld.
Seriously. I think he was like, I'd have to research that, but he was like part of this this like research team that was coming up. I mean, he was helped fund it or something like that.
Wow.
And I don't know if this is true. I'd have to go back and research it, but I remember watching something on that, I think on Rachel Maddow, where they were talking about this
this
project that Kevin Costner was involved in with trying to clean up oil. And at first, the Louisiana politicians didn't want to do it because, you know, why would we want to buy a product from this, you know?
Yeah. We'll see if we have crawfish with six pinchers and crabs with 50 legs, you know, very soon. But
I guess we'll know in a few more years.
It actually
sounds interesting, though, that it's less about the real event and more like a disaster movie. That kind of makes me want to see it more. It's about the event, the survival, not getting into all of the things that can bog down the based on a true story subgenre.
Yeah.
I wish they would have given Kurt Russell more to do because in the early portions of the movie, you're like, yes, finally, somebody is going to give Kurt Russell an Oscar nomination. This is fantastic. He's great. It's a great role. And, he just got bonked on the head.
Does he turn into Snake Plissken?
No, but it's a movie that shows just how great an actor Kurt Russell, an underrated actor,
sure,
Kurt Russell is.
Right.
And then the movie, once all of the craziness starts happening, the movie just sort of forgets about him. Huh. And it's like, come on.
All right. So a slow to theater.
Yeah, a slow theater. I like that. Deepwater Horizon. Yeah.
The Birth of a Nation is another big one.
Yeah.
This has been garnering a lot of attention. At least it's been on your radar screen, more so than on mine.
Well, it's been, I mean, we've been talking about it since January. If you remember when Matt was here, we talked to him about Sundance.
Yeah, and, I guess I remember that. Very vaguely now.
You know, this is the movie that is from Nathaniel Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Nate Parker, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote and directed it. It's been a baby project of his for a long, long time. Showed it at Sundance. Won every award conceivable at Sundance. Got picked up from Fox Searchlight for a Oscar season rollout starting this week.
Wasn't it the biggest purchase at Sundance ever or something
They paid $17.5 million for it.
Mm.
It was picked up right in the moments where everybody was going crazy about Oscar So White again for the second time in a row.
Mm-hmm.
It was immediately ordained as the best picture front runner and, you know, the most vital and important movie that was going to get released this year.
Yeah.
And I really don't know how to talk about this because it shouldn't, I mean, it should color our feelings toward the movie a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but I'm really not sure how much they should color our feelings toward the movie.
Okay.
But 15 years ago, I a little over 50. I have to look it up, to be honest.
Sure.
I don't have it in front of me right now, which is my fault.
But years ago, we can say.
When Nathaniel Parker was a student at Penn State, he mm-hmm. allegedly raped a woman when he was on the wrestling team.
Okay.
He did it with his writing partner on this movie, actually, who was also his roommate, Jean McGinney Celestine.
Mm-hmm.
They were both charged with raping the student. Jean Celestine was convicted, and then that conviction was subsequently overturned, and the DA decided not to put the charges back forth again. Parker was not charged. He was exonerated. I mean, he says he's exonerated. There's other ways to look at it, whatever. And then a couple of years ago, though, the woman in question committed suicide. She was still so distraught over everything that had happened during that period of time while she was at Penn State, she actually took her own life a couple of years ago.
Wow.
That information can't help but color your opinion at least somewhat watching the movie.
Sure.
The movie is a recount of the Nat Turner Revolution right before the Civil War. Nat Turner was a slave living in the Deep South, and in 1831 he staged basically a 24-hour, 48-hour revolution.
Okay.
And during that revolution, anywhere between about 50 to 70 people, men, women, and children, were slaughtered and murdered in their beds.
Wow.
By a number of slaves that Nat Turner had been able to convince to join him, thinking that if they could start this, thousands upon thousands of fellow slaves would rise up and join them.
Hmm.
And it was ended before it ever had a chance to begin. And this movie is a vivid portrayal of what led up to that revolution and then the revolution itself.
Hmm.
Nate Parker, again, he wrote and directed it. He also stars as Nat Turner.
Mm-hmm.
He's very good in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is freakishly well shot. It's really emotionally involving. Especially right now with Black Lives Matter going on in the middle of this political season with the election that we're having, the movie is important.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to tell people to go see it, not only because of what allegedly Parker did while he was a student at Penn State,
mm-hmm.
but because also there are some minor problems with the movie that I can't quite understand why Parker went there. And I can't decide if my feelings in that regard are shaped by what I now know about this rape allegation,
mm-hmm.
or if I would have felt that way had I not known going into the movie
mm-hmm.
about the rape allegation. And I mean, the female characters in the movie are really one dimensional. They only exist to push the male characters into revolution. There are a couple rape sequences in the movie that, yes, this undeniably happened. During this period of time, yes, these things took place.
Mm-hmm.
But in the context of the movie, they're used solely just to gin up anger in other black characters so that they fight in this revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no greater context to anything that's taking place as far as that side of the coin is concerned. it's a really hard movie for me to feel like I can talk about rationally.
Sure.
Or that I'm the right person to be talking about it.
Sure.
I think it's well made. I do think the themes that it's talking about should be talked, I mean, should be discussed and debated right now, especially in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not sure this movie is the one that needs to be doing it.
Okay. So Birth of a Nation getting sort of a mixed review out of you on this at this
yeah.
point. So, and I can't form an opinion on it because I haven't seen it. And John, you haven't seen it either. So
nope.
We're all kind of scratching our head going, well, what do we do with this?
Hopefully okay. that all made sense.
All right. Well, we shall see. And I guess the time will tell what happens after this weekend. So okay, Birth of a Nation. So you're putting that into the rental category-ish? Or would you say this is theater-ish?
I don't even want to put it in any category right now, really,
okay.
to be honest. I mean, it's a good enough movie. People should see it. How they see it is going to be up to them.
Okay. Okay. So big question marks looming over that altogether.
Yes.
Okay.
I will say it's Oscar. Because of this, its Oscar chances are dead.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that leaves us with The Girl on the Train. And if you're not familiar with the book, which this seems to be the book that so many of the women I work with have all said, oh, I read it. Tell me about this film. Is it any good? I mean, I've had more people ask me about this based on the book. So the book itself, written by Paula Hawkins, directed by Tate Taylor. We've got The Girl on the Train starring Emily Blunt. And Emily Blunt's character is a woman named Rachel, and she is an alcoholic divorcee, recently divorced woman. And she's been divorced from a man by the name of Tom. That's Justin Theroux. And he has sort of an interesting past himself, and it's rather sketchy throughout the entire film as to what happened to Rachel and Tom and what caused their breakup. Meanwhile, Tom is now with his new wife, Anna. That's Rebecca Ferguson. And meanwhile, they happen to have a nanny, and her name is Megan. That's Haley Bennett. And so between all of them, there's this kind of intermingling of which, and we eventually see that Megan disappears. And it turns out that Emily Blunt's character, Rachel, has seen maybe a clue or a hint of what happened to Megan from the seat of a train as she's driving, or not driving, but riding past her old neighborhood, which she seems to be kind of hung up in. She's sort of in limbo post-divorce.
Sure.
And this whole film is sort of the, let's put the pieces together on this whodunit mystery suspense thriller. I mean, that's kind of the sum of the parts. Sarah, for me, this one I watched, I'm going, well, act one starts out nice and strong and mysterious, and there's a lot of question marks and a lot of moving pieces, and it certainly seems to be obscured with alcoholism, and we're seeing this view through Emily Blunt's eyes, and that's what makes it so confusing, is we're seeing it through the eyes of an alcoholic. By the time we get to act three and we start assembling everything and there's actually some clarity and lucid vision and thought, it just kind of fell flat for me. And interestingly enough, this is where Danny Elfman pops up, because he's the ones doing the score on this film. Well, he wasn't doing it with Tim Burton. He actually did make the score on this. So interesting all around. Music to me was a little flat throughout, and I felt the whole film overall flat throughout. Where do you sit on this?
So I have read Paula Hawkins' novel, and I was curious going into the movie, because the novel is sort of a three-prong narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You get the whole thing from Rachel's, Anna's, and Megan's point of views, and they're presented almost as first person diary entries.
Okay.
And it switches continually throughout the book as to who you are following at any one time.
Sure.
And I was curious how the movie was going to try to duplicate that. And
seems like they maybe tried it a little bit.
And I think early on, Tate Taylor, who directed The Help, which was a better movie.
Sure.
And screenwriter Aaron Cressida Wilson, I think they actually do a good job of that in the first 15-20 minutes, where they really do try to separate each woman's point of view as to what is going on and why in their lives and how the other women have affected their lives in this sort of triptych style.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually quite well done. Even though we know almost immediately we're going to see the majority of this through Rachel Emily Blunt's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you can't trust her as a narrator. You just can't, because she's a drunk, and she knows she's a drunk, and she knows that she loses time. Emily Blunt, I'm not going to say she's spectacular in this movie. I think she's given better performances.
Sure.
That does not discount at all how good she is in this movie.
Yeah.
As a portrait of an alcoholic trying to bring themselves out of the ashes of their own ruined life, I think she does a great job.
Yeah.
And as somebody that's worked with alcoholics and been in that field, you feel what she's going through. She makes it real. It's authentic. And she is the reason to watch this movie.
Sure.
The book, because it's well enough written, gets away with some of its sillier coincidences.
Sure.
The book, because it's so well written, gets away with an ending that's borderline laughable.
Yes.
The movie does not.
That's my thinking exactly.
It's also, so the ending doesn't work at all. And Tate Taylor doesn't seem to bring anything else to the movie.
Yeah.
It's after the setup, after you learn that Megan is missing, mm-hmm. and after you learn what the dynamic between these three women is, there's no energy to the movie.
Yeah.
It's very flat. It's oddly boring.
Yeah.
And you've got incredible actors popping up in some supporting roles, like Edgar Ramirez and...
what's her name?
Luke Evans. I mean, there's people, Allison Janney. I mean, you have people and popping up
Phoebe,
in these.
Phoebe pops
yeah,
up.
Which is actually a great, there's a great little Friends moment in there, thanks to Lisa Kudrow that made me chuckle. They don't get anything really to do.
Sure.
The movie is bizarrely boring for this, you know, gnarly B-grade thriller.
Yeah.
I hate to do it because Emily Blunt's so good in the movie and I like what she's saying about alcoholism, but it's a pass.
Yeah. And I put it as a rental, really. I mean, I just say, you know, it's interesting. And you're right. I thought on the acting scale, I thought all the players, they do a great part. They do great things. It's just unfortunate that I think the film is, well, it's kind of a victim of its own devices, really, and just kind of falls flat too. So you're a pass. I'm a rent. Let's call it good on that.
I think that's good. Let's talk about fun stuff.
Let's talk about the good stuff.
It's Halloween month. Come on. And we've got a horror maestro here.
Yeah. So, John, tell us a little bit about this. Valley of the Sasquatch garnering much attention. Our producer, Sprints, handed me a sheet here showing me just how many awards you've gotten. I was like, I'm looking here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I mean, you have garnered a ton of awards since we last spoke with you. Tell us a little bit what's going on. How many of these are on your mantle at this point?
For hunting ground. Sorry, we should be. It's for hunting ground.
Oh, right. Yes. But let's clarify, too. Explain.
Okay. Well, I directed this film, which last year I spoke with you guys about, called Valley of the Sasquatch at that time. That was the title on the script. That was the poster we designed. And then it took about a year and a half to get distribution. It turns out that people weren't as excited about a Bigfoot movie as I was in the distribution world. Of course, we played at a myriad of festivals, won a lot of awards. That was very nice. Everything ranging from cinematography to Best of the Fest to Best Acting Awards. And it just was something where I loved the movie, put my love of Sasquatch into the movie. And from a sales point of view, I guess the distributors were like, why would anyone care that much about Sasquatch? So they rechristened it Hunting Grounds, and we're looking at an early 2017 DVD release date under that title in the U.S. One thing that's kind of interesting is foreign fans can see it as Valley of the Sasquatch with a totally different ad campaign.
Fantastic. And is there a regionality to that DVD if they wanted to get a hold of the foreign copy? I mean, is there?
There probably would be. Yeah, it'd be like Region 2. I think it's sold in the U.K. and in South Korea. There's been a few places, but that'll also be early next year when people can see that. Luckily, the movie will be the same. There's going to be nothing different about it beyond the title screen, and for that, I'm very thankful. The distributors enjoyed the film enough not to slice it up.
So they didn't make you change it at all. That's great.
Yeah.
And do you know if you're going to get an iTunes release on that either at this point?
Yeah, that'll be digital platforms. You'll probably be able to find it, Amazon, iTunes, hopefully Redbox, Walmart. The distribution company we went with, Uncorked Entertainment, has a good relationship with those outlets. So we'll see. You know, early 2017 will be Sasquatch time, apparently, they're thinking.
A
lot of the stuff with Uncorked, they usually, about a month before, they... premiere it on their DirecTV platform. Are they going to be doing that? Do you know?
That I'm not aware of yet. We're kind of still figuring out the sales plan as they unroll things. So far, they've announced the title, but I know we have some art and a trailer coming soon, and then they'll probably get into specifics about those plans with release dates and everything.
Now, have you had a chance to see some of that artwork that would be on your album, or your album cover, on your video, your film's cover? I mean, have they shared that with you? Do they have?
Yeah, they've been very upfront about what they're thinking about with the trailer and the poster design. and there's been notes that me and my producers have had on each. Mm-hmm. And I will say that as someone who makes low-budget indie films, I have had much worse retitles than Hunting Grounds. I have had much worse covers than the cover that they're presenting. But I will say that if you ever want to see what the filmmakers intend, it's valleyofthesasquatch.com. I'm sure at some point we'll have to make huntinggrounds.com. You can see the original art and how we kind of would have presented the film.
For people that want to know, the original poster is still on IMDb, and it's awesome.
That's because I'm the one uploading it. I think that'll probably stay on there. The title change is confusing, so I'm sure eventually I'll put the Hunting Grounds one.
Now, here's the one. Hold on, sir. Okay. I know you got a serious question. I've got a screwball question.
I got a serious question.
Washington State Fair, or otherwise affectionately known as the Puyallup Fair, they have a new, I'll call him a mascot, which happens to be a Bigfoot called Big Washington, apparently. Has your film seen any increase of attention due to Big Washington now or anything like that? I mean, this has become a monumental thing. I mean, you may have even been ahead of the curve here.
Maybe, yeah. I think we might have been a few months ahead of it. I don't know if there's any correlation between Big Washington, although maybe someone was in, the sold-out SIFF screening, and they're like,
Now here's an idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of that sold-out SIFF screening, so I know Uncorked has done this for a few of their titles. They haven't actually brought any to Seattle before, but they have released a few in a couple theaters in some locations. Mm-hmm. Has there been any talk about letting you screen this maybe over, maybe with SIFF again over at the Uptown, or maybe like at midnight at the Egyptian, doing like a couple one-off screenings before it hits video here in Seattle in your hometown?
Yeah, I think that would be something that I'm going to talk with them about. We have had a few local screenings. We played at the Grand Illusions All Monsters Attack series last Halloween. So it's been kind of interesting that it's just like taken this long. It's been the longest time between festival premiere and home video debut. So I think if we threw it up in the theater, people would come out to see it. With our other films, we've also had kind of pre-release parties at Scarecrow Video. The first place you can get the film with our previous releases was at Scarecrow, so I'm hoping to do something similar. But those talks will continue into the winter, and we'll sort of see how that rolls out. It's really about, I think, interest from the outlets. If theaters that they're talking to are interested, then that becomes an option. If these VOD outlets are interested, that becomes an option.
Hey, speaking of Scarecrow, which is the best damn video store in the world, to quote Dan Duty.
It really is.
Yeah, without a doubt.
You are really... So they've got this thing going on right now, Adam. What's it called?
It's the Scarecrow Video Psycho Challenge.
Psychotronic.
Psychotronic Challenge. You are correct. And this adjective, denoting or relating to a genre of films that typically have a science fiction, horror, or fantasy theme, and are made on a low budget. That being said,
you have been participating, John. I see you tweeting every single. So they've given us 31 days.
31, one for every day of the month.
Yeah.
Yes, there's a guideline for every kind of subgenre that you can find in Scarecrow's outstanding psychotronic room, where I'm happy to have a couple of our films are in there. And you'll also notice on the Bigfoot section that I am the sponsor of that section. Strangely enough, there is not a Bigfoot day in the guidelines. I kind of need to talk to them about that.
Yeah, what's up with that? come on.
But there's just a really fun way. They have a lot of these 31 days of Halloween, 31 days of horror challenges have been going on since the start of social media. People just cramming all of their horror viewing into one month. But Scarecrow decided to set up these guidelines with the Psychotronic Challenge, and you can keep up with it on Instagram and Twitter and everything with the hashtag SCV Psycho Challenge. Mm-hmm. And so I've just been, going through these, watching them. Today we have to watch something based on a novel. It's the Bookworm Day. So I'm going to be leaving here to watch Pet Sematary again.
Oh, sounds good. Man, what a choice. And Achilles Tendon. Who
yeah, I can't deal with that movie. That's one of the few horror movies I absolutely cannot deal with.
When you say cannot deal with, how does it, you cannot deal with it, in what regard?
I don't like how it deals with the child, to be honest.
Oh, but it's an amazing performance. Two-year-old Miko Hughes, that's one of my favorite performances in any film. And you can work out interesting kind of marathons. Like, I love sequels and watching full franchises over the course of October. So actually, later on in the month, we have a zombie day. That'll be my time to watch Pet Sematary 2 with Eddie Furlong.
Wow.
So how did you deal with part 4 day then?
Yeah, which was the part 4 day, the 4th of October, any fourth part of a film series.
Well, another franchise that I was digging into was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That was Yes, as far as the main franchises, that's one of the few where I haven't seen a couple, the more recent ones.
Right.
And so the 3rd day in October was Director Day, something from a well-known auteur. Mm-hmm. So I went with kind of lost auteur Toby Hooper and watched the original Texas Chainsaw.
Oh, yeah.
And then part 4 day came afterwards. And of course, that is the very unfortunate film, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm. Who's in that, by the way?
Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger. It's a Dazed to Confused reunion.
Right.
And he says it in the movie, and it's supposedly horrifying, but it's not at all.
Does he say, all right, yes. All right? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, Matthew, I haven't watched this movie forever, but Matthew McConaughey is actually kind of genius in the movie. He's so bad in the movie. He's
bug
awesome.
Nuts. Yeah.
He is just incredible.
It is honestly one of the worst films I've ever seen, but that's the fun of this challenge. You can go from the classic of the original to the depths of part 4, and those days are back to back. And throughout the rest of the month, there's going to be things like Horror Host Day. That's where I'll finally be able to watch Texas Chainsaw 2, which features a deleted scene with Joe Bob Briggs.
Wow.
I'm looking forward to Dragons Ate My Blacksmith Day, just so that I can watch Dragon Slayer and tweet out about the fact that, come on, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Disney, whichever one of you holds the rights to this, put that freaking movie out on Blu-ray, because it's the most amazing dragon movie ever made.
October 13th, coming right up on that one. For Dragons Ate My Blacksmith, by
Dragons
the way.
Dragons Ate My Blacksmith.
If you wanted more information, by the way, you can get it at Scarecrow's website. Also, you can find him at facebook.com/scarecrowvideo, and you can see the whole list here, the entire challenge, right before your very eyes on that. This is really quite the list.
Amazing.
Sarah, do you have a favorite day here besides the Dragons Ate My Blacksmith day that you've had a chance to peruse this a little closer, right? Is there anyone standing out more than the others for you?
I'm kind of looking forward to Black Sunday Day.
Okay.
Only because there's a couple fun Hammer films that would be really enjoyable to watch on that day.
And Black Sunday includes witches, warlocks, voodoo priests, etc.
Yes.
See if you can conjure the strength to make it one more day. John, how about you? I mean, you've been doing this. Is there one that's just like going to leap out at you here, do you think?
Yeah, coming up on the 29th, we've got the Moonful of Puppies Day, which is you have to watch a werewolfer.
Uh-huh.
And I like to extol the virtues of An American Werewolf in London anytime I can. I will be watching the new Blu-ray that just came out. That's my favorite horror movie of all time. So a rewatch is in order.
Wow. American Werewolf in London, which immediately just draws me back to the Michael Jackson Thriller video, too, or the making of Thriller, of which that came out exactly the same time.
Yep.
And they used some of the same bits and pieces.
Yeah.
So
I was thinking on that day, because I was going to basically do 1981 werewolf movies.
Oh, perfect.
You know, so here's my thing. The Howling, yes, a classic, amazing. American Werewolf in London, one of the great, I mean, I'm not even going to say one of the greatest horror movies of all time. It's one of the greatest movies of all time, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we give more love to Woofen? It's out on Blu-ray now, too. It's a good movie. I know it's not exactly what the director intended, but it's a really good film with a great Albert Finney.
I thought you were going to bring up Full Moon High, which
Ooh,
is the
that's
forgotten
also 1981.
Fourth.
Yeah, that's the forgotten fourth from 81.
No, but Woofen is very fun.
Not exactly a werewolf. Or where would you put Cujo on that? Would that fit into the Moonful of Puppies? I mean, it technically, Cujo is a dog.
No, you could watch that. You could watch that today.
Yes, so that's true. Based on a Stephen King novel, so
again,
you can watch that for the Bookworm Day. There's actually a Nature Attack Day, so that could be when you watch Cujo or Frogs or Squirm.
Ants.
Yep.
I just got the Arrow Blu-ray of Slugs.
Perfect.
There we go.
Wow. I'm not familiar with Slugs.
It's exactly what you think it is.
Really?
Yes.
Is this like Slither?
No. Slither's a better movie.
Really?
Yes, this is the slow little slugs. They put little fake teeth on them, and they get in people's gloves, and so, of course, you have to chop your hand off if there's a slug in your glove. It's a Spanish film. It's ridiculous. It's from the director of Pieces, if any listeners know of that outrageous film.
Oh, my God. Wow.
But set here. It's set in just like upstate New York or something like that, and... So you get a lot of Italian. I mean, there's a couple very American actors in the leads, and then it's all like Italians and Spaniards in the other roles, all with really horrible American accents or being really badly dubbed. It's fantastic, and some freakishly insane makeup effects.
That's kind of the interesting thing about horror is this seems to be international. There's like it's like the love is the international language. Horror can also be the international language. This has been a good year for horror too. As a matter of fact, Sarah, you were kind of extolling the virtues of 2016. What if 2016 has stood out for you out of all of these?
Well, it's one that nobody right now. There's one that nobody, unfortunately, is going to really go see.
Mm-hmm.
But it played at SIFF, and it's going into limited release on Friday today, and it should be available on Netflix really soon because I think they're one of the people that's distributing it. But it's an Iranian film called Under the Shadow, which is one of the best films I've seen this year. It's about a woman. Her husband gets recalled into service and has to go back to the front lines It's set during the Iran-Iraq conflict. And she's at home with her young son, and there might be a ghost in the house.
Interesting.
And it's awesome. This movie freaked the heck out of me when we saw it at SIFF. It's one of the best movies I've seen flat out this year.
No
just
kidding.
Remarkable. But, I mean, you look at this year. It's like 10 Cloverfield Lane, The Witch, Don't Breathe, The Shallows. So many of these movies, even Purge 3. I mean, they've all done really well, gotten decent reviews. Audiences have just been flocking to them. It's just been a solid year, and John and I were talking about this last night. The hysterical part is, so Don't Breathe comes out at the end of August, does massive business.
And is an amazingly entertaining film.
Yeah, exactly. And immediately, all of these articles were being written about, oh, horror is back, horror is king.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd go on Twitter, and it's like, oh, my God, everybody go see a horror movie. Horror is doing so great right now this year. 2 weeks later, Blair Witch comes out. Which is a good movie. Adam Wingard and Simon Barrett. You know,
yeah.
I think
we all walked away from it kind of feeling pretty good about it at the time.
Yeah. But it didn't do the box office that Lionsgate wanted it to. And immediately, like the very next day, horror's dead.
Yeah. It's kind of like the news industry. It's like one day we're reading a story, the five things about chocolate that'll kill you. And then the next day it's like, chocolate's great for you, good for the heart. And it just, I mean, we do this every, it's the ping pong effect of it. It wears very thin on me.
Well, for you, John, I mean, you go see all these movies. I mean, we were talking about this. It's like you don't get a lot of opportunities to go see stuff in the theater, but.
Yeah, when I do, I go and see horror movies. So, you know, over the summer, definitely saw The Shallows opening day, had fun with that. The Conjuring 2 was another one.
Mm-hmm.
And what was so interesting with this year was that a lot of the things that were doing really well or what people were talking about were original movies, Don't Breathe, The Witch. And that was something that I really liked. And so I don't think I necessarily might have enjoyed Blair Witch as much as the two of you, although I did think it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
It was a gigantic step up from Book of Shadows.
But
I was actually thought it was kind of interesting. It showed the marketplace, okay, what usually happens is you take out the franchise from 17 years ago, pull it out of the mothballs, and suddenly, oh, that's a big hit, so we're just going to do the same thing over and over again. We actually were getting original things, new franchises were getting early sequels, but when you try to pull something out from back in the day, people just weren't having that nostalgia. And so Blair Witch, it did fine. It was still a low-budget film, but I think that's pretty interesting. It's letting the studios know, like the audience is telling them, you know, we want something a little bit new, a little bit fresh. I mean, Don't Breathe isn't the most original movie ever made, but the spins it does put on things are good enough to make it seem like a brand new package.
And I like that, you know, yes, we had The Conjuring 2, which was a hit, and it did well. But the other sort of franchise movie of the year was, when we've talked about this many times on the show, but 10 Cloverfield Lane, which kind of wanted to be, it's kind of like Halloween 3.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, you get this feeling they're setting up this anthology series. I would actually have loved the movie if the direct references to Cloverfield weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
If that movie had have stayed in the bunker and that was the movie without getting into spoilers, it would have been like a 9 out of 10. As it is, it's like a 7.
Yeah,
Bed still think it's like the fourth or fifth thing I've seen this year, so yeah. I love it. But I hear what you're saying. But why do you think in 2016 that worked for audiences?
Mm.
This sort of, you know, doing an anthology style sequel instead of a direct sequel. Why did that work now? But in 1983, it didn't work for Halloween 3.
Well, I think we've just got this internet culture and we're kind of used to these things. People are discussing and debating. As soon as that trailer came out, they held it till just 2 months before. No one even knew the movie existed. So then this buzz is this a sequel? How does it relate to Cloverfield? Are they in the bunker because the monster's running around from the first one up top? And that was really fun to get into that and pick it apart. When Halloween 3 came out in 1982, no one knew what was going on. Even in the, like, Roger Ebert's review, famously, he was confused. He thought the robot that the doctor was digging through throughout the whole movie was Michael Myers, who burned at the end of part two. No one really understood what was going on, and that you could change midstream in a series and just tell a different story. And things like American Horror Story, we now have television shows yeah. mm-hmm. where the characters don't carry through, and you can just hit the reset button at the beginning of every season. And I think that's really interesting, and it's a way to be able to tell just cool stories. I'm excited to see what a 20 Cloverfield Lane could be, or whatever they call it.
Sure. Yeah. I've heard similar things about, I believe it's a British television show called Dark Mirror, which I'm not terribly up to speed on, but from what I understand, the characters are different almost every time. So
it's more of like a Twilight Zone sort of story. I think it's a Black Mirror.
Black Mirror.
Can find it on Netflix. Gotten a lot of great buzz. I unfortunately have not watched it yet, but everyone I know who's seen it will say one of the best shows.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. Real quick, we're starting to run out. Off the Beaten Path, if you guys had to pick one film, and I'll start off with one that I've got here. Actually, I got two in mind. A little more commercial, but the off-the-beaten-path ones the folks don't often think about, I'd say, one, go back to the basics, go back to Nosferatu, the original release, just to watch the black-and-white thing. You can actually get it on YouTube for free.
You mean the Max Schreck 1922?
Max Schreck 1922. Okay. I used to have a license plate that said Nosferatu. number one. Number two, I would say, this came out a couple years ago, Trick or Treat.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a number of little vignettes that all string together in a very clever, fun way. Didn't get a lot of attention when it originally came out, but I think it's one that definitely deserves your attention now.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's one where if it was released now, mm-hmm. it would really be this big hit. Where when it came out, 6 years ago, it was dumped straight to video. The studio didn't know what it was.
And then Warner Brothers delayed that forever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you look at what he had with Krampus just last year, and that movie did well.
Yeah,
exactly. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thinking about Off the Beaten Path horror, one movie that I always tell people is one of the scariest movies I've ever seen is The Entity. It's from the early 80s with Barbara Hershey, and it is horrifying. It is supposedly based on a true story of a single mother who had a poltergeist in her house and was repeatedly raped by this poltergeist over the course of several months. And even if that's not a true story and that it really happened, this woman believed it happened.
Sure.
And that's a very interesting point of view for the movie. And just the way it's presented is horrifying. Barbara Hershey gives a really daring performance. And so she's just outstanding. And then another one, little lighter fare, a great animal attack movie, going back to what we were talking about with Cujo, Kingdom of the Spiders with William Shatner from the late 70s. It's just Shatner versus a bunch of tarantulas in the desert, and these are actors covered in tarantulas. There will be scenes where someone's hiding on a swing, and the entire ground is moving, and all you can see are tarantulas. Nowadays, it would be CGI. It would be terrible. This is a really fun movie and really freaky if you're arachnophobic like I am.
Fantastic. So, again, what were the names of yours?
The Entity and Kingdom of the Spiders.
Okay.
Good choices.
Sarah, how about you?
I'm going to go for one from this year.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Turkish horror film called Baskin.
Hmm.
I'm not going to say it's a great movie, but it's sort of like a Turkish Hellraiser. And it is insanely gory. And even if the story gets a little weak, the stuff that's going on in this movie is so freaky and so unsettling and just so blood-curdling that by the time it was over, I was literally shaking.
Wow.
So it's effective.
I mean,
I could have had a better plot, yes, but the themes and the way that the stuff is showcased really gets under your skin. I think one of the scariest movies I've ever seen, though, is a Dutch horror film called The Vanishing. Not the remake with Kiefer Sutherland.
Right.
When Jeff Bridges is really good in the remake, even though the remake's not very good. but the original from 1988, one of the flat-out scariest movies you will ever watch, and it's because it's just this growing tension and something insidious is going on. Something bad is happening, and you feel it throughout the entire movie, and then it has this ending that you cannot talk about. That is one of the flat out most terrifying things you will ever see, and it's guaranteed to give you nightmares.
Wow.
And I think those are two that are off the beaten path that are not your traditional, let's go watch The Exorcist.
Sure. Sure. Easy film, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Real quick notes. Also, I want to say thanks much to Carl Spence for all of his help with Seattle International Film Festival. Carl, hanging up the hat, so to speak.
He's been a longtime friend. We love Carl.
Yeah. So, Carl, we'll miss you, but good luck on your future ventures, whatever they may be.
Exactly. Wishing him well.
And, Sarah, you were telling us a little about Twist is coming up.
Yep.
As far as the
rebranding of the Lesbian and Gay Film Festival. It is now called Twist.
Uh-huh.
A Seattle's queer film festival.
When does that kick off?
That kicks off on Thursday next week, so the 13th.
Okay.
And it runs for 10 days. I've interviewed Jason Plourd, and I'm going to have an article in the SGN today talking about the festival and the changes and the lineup. And it's going to be a pretty amazing festival this year. They've got some really great stuff.
Okay.
Over the next 10 days, starting next Thursday.
Very cool. And to recap a little bit about what we talked about tonight, Miss Peregrine's Home for the Peculiar Children getting a somewhat recommendation for rental from Sarah. Deepwater Horizon getting a slow theater recommendation from Sarah. Birth of a Nation, getting a big question mark, a lot looming still around that, and kind of in the undecided category, which is a first for us, as a matter of fact. The Girl on the Train, one recommendation as a rental, one recommendation as a skip, and that kind of sums it up for us on that altogether. Wanted to put a big thank you out to Victoria Radio, said they've been playing us. As far as Cinema Squabble is concerned as
That's
well.
Awesome.
So there you go. So thanks, Victoria Radio. Thank you very much. And
hopefully you enjoy our horror-centric show this month.
Yeah. And a big thanks, John Portnova, for joining us once again to talk all things Sasquatch and horror.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. Sarah Michelle Fetters, Adam Gerke. This is Cinema Squabble, episode 43. And Sprint's Arbogast, our producer this evening. Thank you very much.